This morning, tough question we want to think about. We got a lot to say, so put your seatbelts on, get your thinking caps on. This will definitely be the most intellectually rigorous of the lesson. So I don't mean to scare you, but it's first thing in the morning, right? We've had breakfast, we're ready to think, and hopefully go on a good journey together. This picture on the left, of course, you recognize Ruby. That was one of a number of pictures that we took along some of her struggles in the valley, if you will. That was one of the saddest days there. Just has kind of a look of, I don't know, almost looked like she'd given up in that picture. She was really hurting, and thankfully that day is a little bit of a blur in my mind among many other days. I remember it was a sad occasion, but thankfully that's in the past. But I came across this quote from Dan Barker a couple years ago, and it really resonated with me. I'm like, you know, I can see where he's coming from. I believe he's wrong, but I can see exactly where he would come up with this statement, where he said, all you have to do is to walk into any children's hospital, and you'll know when you walk out there's no God. Now, why would he say that? Well, he had experienced some tragedy in his life, and he could not, before he was a Bible believer, but he could not reconcile in his mind how these things could happen to these children, whom he viewed, and as I think we'd all view, children are innocent. How could these things happen to innocent human beings and God, if he's really out there, do nothing? He could not come up with an answer to that. He just thought, and you go down the halls of these hospitals and you see the kids on chemo, you see the kids, a lot of kids suffering, you see children that will die because they have afflictions that we just don't know how to resolve. It's a sad place. Yet there's some great people there trying to serve. This is really, in my mind, friends, the strongest argument that atheists have. Evolutionary theory, that's not a strong argument. But this is what has often been called the problem of evil. It was stated quite articulately even back before Jesus walked the earth. Epicurus said in the 3rd century BC, God either wishes to take away evils and is unable, or he's able to take away the evils but unwilling to do so, or he is neither willing nor able, or he is both willing and able, again, to take away evils in the world. And then he elaborates on these options. If God is willing to take away evil but unable to do so, he's weak, he's feeble, which is not in accordance with the character of God. If God is able to take away evils but he's not willing to do so, then he must be envious, which is equally at variance with God, he affirmed. If he's not able or willing to take away evils in the world, he's both envious and feeble and therefore not God. And then his 4th option, if he's both willing and able, which is alone suitable for a God, what source then are evils? Why does he not remove them? Did you follow that? Let's break this down. If there's really an all-powerful, all-loving, all-knowing being out there, then he knows about the evils on the earth. And if he has the power to remove them, why doesn't he? Why particularly do innocent people suffer? It just doesn't seem to match up with the idea of an all-powerful, all-loving God. That's what he affirmed. It's a tough question. You know, where is God? How can God love us and still allow us to suffer? Is that even possible? Well, it's a deep and very complex question. There's a number of ways to answer it, but I think this is actually the best way to answer. And I know that's a pretty graphic image, but I think from my readings and studies, I think it's a pretty realistic image for how Jesus might have looked on the cross. The scourging, crown of thorns, there would have been blood everywhere. I mean, he died on the cross. And a lot of people died even from scourging before they got there. But as complicated as this question is, you know, where is God, an all-powerful, all-knowing God, when the innocent suffer? This is where you can start to answer the question. What do I mean? Well, there was a great amount of purpose and planning for why Jesus ended up on the cross, right? God had a plan worked out from before the foundation of the earth was laid. Revelation 13:8. Jesus never sinned. He is the definition of innocent. He accepted the sins of the world and all the suffering on the cross that went along with that. So we would suggest, in big picture terms here, God is not deficient in power. He's not deficient in love. He actually has a purpose for suffering, for allowing suffering. We've already kind of laid that principle in our prior lessons. We may not always understand, but we've seen there can be benefits from suffering. And if God knows best, we can even have some terrible suffering, like on the cross with Christ, and there'd be a reason for God to allow it. All right, let's dive into some philosophy here, okay? You don't need to be scared of philosophy. You have to be careful not to let it override what the Bible teaches. But I think they blend together. Good philosophy blends with good Bible interpretation, just like good science blends with good Bible interpretation. They're not diametrically opposed. God's the creator of all. Let's talk about the attributes of God, okay? Now, this is where I really want you to put your thinking caps on, okay? All right. We've already said we believe God is all-knowing, all-powerful, all-loving. He's all these things. And yet, now bear with me here, there are limits to what an all-powerful being can do. Now, that's not blasphemy, just bear with me here. We already know God has some limits that are self-imposed. There are things we can do that God cannot do, and that's not something to brag about. We can sin and God cannot sin. We can lie. We can deceive. God will not lie. This is against His character. Hebrews 6:18. Titus 1:2. But more to how we define things. Can God make a four-sided triangle? He cannot. Because by definition, a triangle has three sides. Now, does that mean God is deficient in power? Not at all. Let me state it like this. This is how we should be precise in our language. God is powerful enough to do anything He desires that is subject to power. God can't make a four-sided triangle, but it's not a matter of His lacking power. It's just a logical contradiction. Okay? It's a logical contradiction. Now, why am I bringing this up? Well, there's a very important application that we're going to build up to try to connect some dots here. So there are some limits to what an omnipotent, omniscient being can do. So there are certain things that just aren't subject to power. What about man as a free moral agent? If you've heard that phrase before, it'll be familiar. It just basically means humans, you and I, have a gift from God that we can make choices. Of course, the choices we make, there are consequences, right? Consequences to the choices that we make. Now, when God chose to make human beings, He had two choices so far as free will is concerned. He could have made all of us to be puppets. Now, what do I mean by that? Beings that have no free choices, that just whatever we do is always going to be right. Now, how could that be, Stephen? Well, if God had never defined anything as being wrong and just anything we could say or do would always be right, there's a sense in which we would be puppets. Now, let me back up and try to elaborate on that. You know what it means for someone to love you? Different ones here might define that differently. You know, love is when Mom makes a nice dinner, right? Or love is when Mama cleans up my skin knees if I've fallen off my bike or if something happens. Okay. We understand love is when someone chooses to show kindness and compassion and they're giving of themselves to benefit.
us. So we understand love, seeking what's in the best interest of another person. But friends, that involves choice as well. God created humans with having choice so that they could decide for themselves. We can decide for ourselves if we want to serve God or not. God could have set this up where we were just slaves and robots and we couldn't do anything but exactly what His will is. Are you with me? He could have set it up that way. But He didn't want to set it up that way. He wanted us to be able to freely choose. But here's the danger of a being that can choose. That being can choose to rebel. I really believe that's the reason why, at least one of the reasons why, God created the tree of knowledge of good and evil in the Garden of Eden. You carefully read that early Genesis account, and there is nothing that's forbidden to Adam and Eve except eating of that tree of knowledge of good and evil. If God hadn't created that tree, literally anything Adam and Eve would have done would have been okay. But when God creates that tree and says, don't eat it, He is now giving them free will, the ability to freely choose. And then when they see that tree and they say, I could walk over and eat that fruit, but I'm not going to. I'm going to choose not to because God doesn't want me to. Did God stop them when they went over to the tree and Eve plucked and was tempted and ate and she handed to her? Did God stop them? No. Could He have stopped them? Sure He could have. It wasn't like He was oblivious to what was going on. He knew. He knew. But in order for humans to really love, you've got to have free choice. Adults, you know of what I speak. Love in a marriage is a beautiful thing. It can be. But when someone chooses betrayal, and someone chooses to go a different way, I mean, hearts can be broken. That's all a part of free will, and sometimes it gets abused. We'll come back to that if we have time. Let's talk briefly about good and evil. We're kind of defining some terms here. Well, you know what? I forgot to connect the dots on 1 and 2. So we said under point 1 that there are certain things that God can't do just because they're not subject to power. And the main application of that on 2 is this. It's impossible for God, even though He's all-loving and all-powerful, to create free moral agents. In other words, humans that really have the ability to choose. It's impossible, logically, to create humans that have the ability to choose and for God to guarantee that they're always going to choose the right thing. Because as soon as He gives me a free choice and I choose to do something wrong, God could interfere and stop me, but then what's He done? He's revoked the free will that He's wanted to give me so that I could use that ultimately, hopefully, to really love Him and serve Him. So it's just like a four-sided triangle. It's a logical contradiction to try to create a four-sided triangle, just like it's a logical contradiction to say God should have made us so that we could never choose to do evil. That goes against the very fabric of what He wanted for us. Okay, let's talk about good and evil. Sometimes we use words and we don't stop and really drill down and think about what these words mean. Good and evil. Well, I can think about intrinsic good, intrinsic evil, and that which is intrinsically neutral. What do I mean by that? If something is intrinsically good, to me that means it's good in and of itself. Okay? For example, believing in God, loving God, becoming a child of His, those are things that are just intrinsically good. They're always good. Something that's intrinsically evil, it's always evil. And when I think about it, I think rejecting God, rebelling against Him, sin in my mind, as God defines it in His Word, that's in my mind really the only intrinsic evil. I think everything else that we might think about
is going to be intrinsically neutral. Now, if you say something's neutral, you're saying in and of itself it's not good or evil. But it can be used in a good or an evil fashion. For example, someone had a real sharp knife. Children, is a sharp knife good or evil? It's neither. It would be in and of itself neutral. Why is it neither? Anybody? You could use a knife to go out and hunt and put food on your table, so to speak. You could use it as a tool. You could also use it to stab somebody. The knife, it's not good or bad. It's how it's used. It's just like guns, right? The whole gun discussion in our society. Guns are neutral. You can use them for good. You can use them for evil. They're tools. You need to use them properly. Television. Is it good or evil? It's neutral. It's used for a lot of evil. You know, people have come to learn the gospel of Christ through television programs, right? Sure. The internet. Is that good or evil? Oh, there's a lot of evil out there. It can be used for good too. Anyway, you get the idea. So, some examples of those. Now, sometimes people say things like, well, that tornado came through town, or that tsunami killed 10,000 people, or whatever. Natural disasters, I would say, are not in and of themselves evil. Now, why do I say that? To me, evil or sin, it has to do with the will. Tornado, that's an inanimate thing, right? It doesn't have a mind of its own. Some would say, well, it still causes great harm and destruction. Absolutely, it does. And if we were going to back up the ball, so to speak, and go back in the past, we might even ask, like, why does our earth have tornadoes? Why does our earth have tsunamis? Why do we have earthquakes? Why do we have famines? Why do we have pestilence? Why do we have all... You know why. Because we live in a fallen world. Why do we live in a fallen world? Because Adam and Eve chose to sin, and they introduced that into the world, and death came with that. A lot of the things that happen in the world are because of the sins of humans. They may not be directly a result of our sins, but the sins of humanity, and we suffer a lot because of that. That doesn't mean tornadoes and other natural disasters have a mind of their own. Evil and good always must be, you know, considered connected to someone's willpower. All right, let's keep moving here. So, here's our conclusion so far. See if you're still with me. A good, all-powerful God cannot eliminate the possibility of evil without either eliminating free will, taking away your ability to choose, or without interfering with their free will when they choose to do evil, just on a sporadic case-by-case basis. So I'm suggesting to you, it's not a contradiction for God to exist and for evil to exist in our world. God created the possibility of evil, but not evil itself. I think there's a difference there to draw out, but I won't spend much time on that just for the sake of our time together here. Okay, I want us to think about man's environment. Have you ever thought about planet Earth? How would you change planet Earth if you were the creator? Now, realize when you make changes, there's always going to be impacts to that, right? You might change something and you think it's an upgrade and not realize all the other things you just blew up, okay, with how the world works. For example, how many of us would like to remove spiders from the air? I mean, what do we really need spiders for? Well, if you understand their place, you might not be so inclined to just remove spiders. What would be the perfect environment? Not just for human beings in physical terms, but the perfect environment for what's called soul making. Now, what do I mean by soul making? It's the most suitable environment where we as spiritual beings, and that's what we are, right? We have a physical body, but inherently we are spirits made in the image of God. Okay? What's the perfect environment where our spirits could grow, could have opportunities for maturing and even correction and guiding, and yet we'd still have choice? What would be a perfect environment for that? Well, we might suggest that we would want to have a place that's not just a pleasure-filled paradise. I know a lot of people want Earth just to be a hedonistic environment. We need a place where there is possibility for adversity, possibility for pain. I think the perfect Earth, perfect environment for man would also allow us to have free choices. Earth has that. How about this point? We would want a realm for man where God's presence is neither too far away, but also not too close. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, there's a few places in Scripture. I think about 2 Thessalonians 2, where God says the people that did not believe the lie, he allowed them to be deceived. Or didn't want to believe the truth, he allowed them to be deceived by a lie. Okay? God could, if he chose, he could come down and walk among us like he did Adam and Eve, right? If he wanted to. He could show a miracle to every human being in a very vivid, undeniable way if he wanted to. I say undeniable. People could see, saw miracles in Scripture and still found ways to deny them if their hearts were hard. So there's no such thing as an undeniable miracle, because that's a matter of perspective and your heart. Anyway, God is close enough, I think, that if we are going to seek him, we'll be able to find him. Ask, seek, knock, the door shall be opened, right? Paul says God is not far. We're groping for him, so to speak. Acts 17, those philosophers in Athens. So God's close enough. He's left enough evidence of his existence that if someone really has a good and honest heart and is seeking, I think they'll find him. He's not so far away as the deists claim. He didn't just set the earth in motion and then leave and abandon us to just random chance and cause and effect. Not at all. God's close enough. But yet he's not so close, whereas we don't feel like we have free will. Let me give you this example. If you are in a workplace environment, adults, and your boss's desk is 10 feet behind yours, and he can always see every little thing you're doing, and you know he's watching every little thing you do. Now, that might make you a really good employee. But on the other hand, what are some going to be tempted to do the moment that boss is on vacation? Well, he's not around. I'm finally, I'm free. I can do what I want. There's a lot of people in our world. They're not seeking God, and his presence is not overwhelming them, and they choose to do their evil. God really wants us to have a genuine choice. He really wants us to choose him, but he doesn't want to force us to choose him. He'll let us rebel. I think the perfect environment is going to provide some challenge for us physically, emotionally, mentally, to encourage our growth. Of course, the perfect environment will provide our basic needs. And this is really significant. This ties into Romans 8:18, which we'll read in a minute here. But the perfect environment for a human being to grow and develop to soul make, so to speak, the pain and the pleasure able to be experienced in that realm needs to be insignificant in comparison to the bigger picture of eternity. Now you might say, wait a minute, Steve. You're saying the pleasure that we can experience here on earth it's a drop in the bucket compared to what the afterlife could hold? Yeah. And you're saying that the pain we can experience here is but a drop in the bucket compared to what we can experience in the air? Yes, I think the Bible teaches that. Let's just look at it right now. Romans 8, verse 18. What did Paul say? And I know he was focusing on one side of the equation here in this passage. But he says, I consider the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us. So he's looking at the suffering side. And he's saying there, man, no matter how much you suffer, it's insignificant compared to the glory, the promise, the hope that God has in store for his faithful. So we talked some about natural calamities already, and I mentioned this in one of the prior lessons that, it's good for us. It's good for us to see adversity, and to experience it. It reminds us of our impermanence. We're not going to live forever. We're all going to die. That's a certainty. It's just uncertain as to when. And when we think about human suffering, we know we live in a law-abiding world. And this bothers people. You know, people ask, well, why didn't God stop Hitler? Why didn't God stop Hitler? Well, could God have stopped Hitler? Of course. Could he have stopped Hitler by stopping his free will? I suppose he could have, but that wasn't his will. God has made this a law-abiding world in which we live in. And you know, if you're building a house, you're going to use bricks, let's say, for a good foundation. Bricks are great. You can rely upon bricks for a foundation. But what makes bricks great for a foundation, they're hard, they are stable. Those same characteristics allow a human being to take a brick and do what? Bash in the skull of another human. It can be used for good or evil. Man is certainly in a position to cause intense and prolonged pain. Hitler certainly did that. We can think of some other bad guys in history who God allowed to do terrible things. We even see in the Bible record, Pharaoh, Nebuchadnezzar. We see some of these leaders who God raised up for a season, and they afflicted God's people. God's people need punished. Particularly, I think about Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar is called the servant of God. He's out there mowing down the enemies of God. He's mowing down God's people. And for 70 years, the Israelites would go into captivity, those that survived. And then what? Then Nebuchadnezzar would get to take his medicine too, the Medes and the Persians. But I digress here. We live in a law-abiding world with cause and effect, and God's not planning to change that for now. Okay? He's not planning to change that for now. So we think about human suffering, and we know that sin in the ultimate sense, is connected to a lot of our suffering, right? Whether it's the world as a whole for natural disasters, I think that's caused because that's not the world that Adam and Eve were created into. I think it was like a tropical paradise, right? But when the earth, when sin entered the world, and of course when the flood came, I think a lot of things changed here in this environment, and a lot of what we suffer is from sin. So, God couldn't have stopped the Holocaust without infringing on free will. He couldn't have stopped, you know, Ted Bundy or any other serial killer without infringing on the free will. It's not a part of his plan at this time, but he's telling us. We just saw in Romans 8:18, he's telling us, no matter what we suffer here, you suffer the tragedy of divorce, you suffer the tragedy of a murder, you suffer the tragedy of the loss of a child. Well, whatever it might be, it hurts. But it's not worthy to be compared to the glory God has reserved. As bad as it is, stay faithful, keep on keeping on, and in the end, God will make all wrongs right. So we only have one probationary period. What does that mean? Well, there's some people that would suggest, well, if you don't get it right in this time in life, you'll get another chance in the afterlife. You can get a second chance. The Bible does not teach that. Hebrews 9:27, death comes and after death comes judgment. Okay, it's appointed unto man to live once and then the judgment. So our purpose in this life, listen to me children, our purpose in this life is to make one decision. You know what that decision is? Are we going to live for ourselves or are we going to live for God? Now, something that I teach my children, we recite certain things. Where's Ruby? Hey, Ruby. What's the purpose of life? Remember? Oh. Where's Rebecca? Rebecca, what's the purpose of life? To fear God and keep His commandments. Ruby, do you remember what success is? Are you nervous? Asa, what's success?
Living your life for God and going to heaven.
Living your life for God and going to heaven.
Now, wait a minute. That's not what the world says. The world says success is making a bunch of money. Or success is being the most beautiful. Or success is having the nicest car, the nicest house. That's what the world says. But the Bible says, God says, you know what real success is? It's choosing to live your life for me. It's choosing to live your life for me and one day going home to glory. Now, we have one purpose in life, to make that decision.
I love how Ecclesiastes ends, right? Ecclesiastes 12, 13 and 14. Let's read it together here. The very end of this fascinating book of Ecclesiastes. Let's hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God, keep His commandments. This is man's all, or this is man's duty. This is where man's fulfillment can be found. For God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether good or evil. God's going to clear away all the nonsense in the end. He's going to make wrongs right. If you were secretly abused or mistreated, or if you've done evil things to others, God sees these things. God will take that into consideration. Any sins not covered by the blood of Christ, we know, will be brought up in judgment. So, friends, I know I've been rushing through this here. We see this law-abiding world in which we live, and there's suffering, and sometimes it appears to be random. We can't figure out why. But we have to remember that no matter what we suffer, no matter how bad it hurts, two things. I mean, we could think about some Bible characters who've suffered more. Is anyone here able to say that they've suffered more than the patriarch Job? I've never met anyone that could say they suffered more or even as much. Loss of all wealth, loss of health, loss of all your children. It's just a horrible thought to even ponder. And yet, God saw him through the valley. There it is. I forgot I had it on the slides here. I consider the sufferings of the present time, they're not worthy to be compared. You know, you think about childbirth. Women, those of you that have brought children to the world, God bless you. It's a wonderful experience. But it's not always wonderful in the moment, right? When those labor pains come on, wow, that's, you know, you can't just say, well, I'm going to take care of that tomorrow. I mean, if it's time, it's time. But this is a good illustration for, I think, judgment in the afterlife. As painful as it is, as much suffering as can be experienced bringing a child into the world, once that child's in your arms, man, mothers, you know, it's an amazing thing. It doesn't mean your body still doesn't hurt, and it doesn't mean there's not healing still needed, but wow, the suffering is not worthy to be compared to what I'm now holding in my arms. So friends, encouragement to us all, hang on. Hang on to what? To your faith. Hang on to one another. You know, one of the major functions of the church, it's not just so we can have a worshiping society together, okay? It's so we can be a family. So that, well, how does Paul put it? So we can rejoice with those who rejoice, so we can weep with those who weep. How do you do that? How do you rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep? Well, you got to spend time together. You got to know each other. That's the only way you can really show love. Spend time together so you can share the successes and be together to uphold one another during the failures, during the suffering. My wife and I, our family are so thankful for brethren just like you who have prayed and have encouraged us. I hope that Ruby's cancer story is over. I don't know that. She gets quarterly checkups, a bunch of tests, and so far, from the most recent past, she's been clear. She's still under some treatment for immunotherapy. That's why her hair is still not quite back where we wish it was. She used to have these beautiful blonde curls. That was a number of years ago now, though. But I hope her journey's over with cancer. We don't know that. There's a good chance, they said, later in life, because of all the harsh chemicals that we put in her body for treatment, that, you know, there's a good chance she'll have some other organ issues down the road. We don't know that. Do I worry about that? Not at all. Not a thing I can do about it. We live one day at a time. And I pray that Ruby will live a good and long life, that she'll be a godly wife and mother if the Lord wills, and that you know, that I would die before her. That would be my will, my wish. But I can't control those things. She might relapse later this year. And that's okay if that happens. We'll do the best we can. We'll keep walking with God, and we will try to be a light, as you all can be a light as well. So although I can understand why Dan Barker would say what he said, I would say to you this morning, he's absolutely wrong. As much as it breaks our heart to see suffering, especially in innocence, innocent children, God has a big plan, and it's unfolding. We have free will. We're in a fallen world, though, a lot of suffering from that. He's going to let things keep rolling. And we can actually grow and become stronger through suffering. If what? If we'll choose. If we'll choose to embrace it and to learn from it. Let me read this conclusion here, if I could. You know, the problem of evil, as atheists suggested, it is solvable. Their best argument has been shown to be unsound. You know, you cannot prove that God doesn't exist because there's evil in the world. Because God, there can be a purpose to suffering. God's attributes, we don't need to compromise them in order to explain the existence of evil. We don't need to say, well, maybe God isn't all-powerful, maybe God isn't all-loving. No, He is. He's both of these things, but He has a purpose. Just like a dad who is spanking his child. He's causing harm temporarily for what purpose? So that hopefully that child will grow up to be self-controlled and disciplined. A surgeon, when a surgeon cuts into a body to perform a surgery, is he harming the flesh? He is. He's harming the body in order that he might be able to do a greater good to it. You got to heal up after the surgery. No one would say that harm is evil. There's a purpose to a surgery, ideally. And hopefully it would be successful. So God can use all kinds of things for our good. And also, remember, earth, the suffering here is insignificant compared to what ultimately we can enjoy, the rewards, the glory that He has reserved for us. And we need to be reminded, this world is impermanent. God is, He'll discipline us as any good father would where we need it. But He wants us to be brought toward Him in obedience. I've learned a little bit about the family here this weekend. Some of you have been brought to God, brought back to God through suffering. Praise be to God for that. Not for the fact that you suffered, but that it was able to direct you back toward Him. So, I don't know if me bouncing around this morning on a pretty complex theme, I hope you've gotten something from this, friends. If you're interested in more studying in this realm, I will tell you a lot of what I presented, some of the core ideas, were from a book I read back in college by Thomas B. Warren. And the title of the book is Have Atheists Proved There Is No God? And that was his doctoral thesis. It's a deep book, but it's got some good meat to think about. I know this is supposed to be a class. It's been more like a lecture. Do you guys have any comments or questions? I would be glad to listen or to hear whatever you might want to share. This is me giving you a choice. Very well. Class dismissed.